Welcome to the good old days. I'm Jerome Manigan. Throughout the month of September, we will be revisiting past issues of the good old days magazine. We're going to start today's program with stories from the September 1987 issue of the good old days magazine. And if you'll remember, 1987, 21 years ago, was the first time the good old days was heard on radio reading services. We're starting today's program with Country Schooling. It's written by E.J. Kershaw. These modern day structures of fancy brick and glass are a far cry from the little old one-room country schoolhouse of years ago. Teaching methods have supposedly improved too, along with modernizing of structures and consolidation of districts. But I don't reckon the student of today are any smarter or learns any better than did the student of yesterday. It's true they are exposed to a wider range of subjects, many of them not even dreamed of as yet even 50 years ago. But I doubt if they assimilate knowledge any better than did their forefathers or make any better use of it. The District 87 schoolhouse in Umatilla County was located at the Four Corners on Stewart Creek. It was known as the Red Schoolhouse. About 2 miles west, Pilot Rock was District 1. Several miles away atop a windy ridge where it could be seen against the sky from almost any direction was the White Schoolhouse. It too was named after the color of the paint, but it was younger in years and more modern in design than was the little Red Schoolhouse where I started my pursuit of the four R's: reading, writing, arithmetic, and responsibility. Yes, the fourth was given consideration in the classroom. At least the building had been painted red at one time. By the time I started the school, it had seen better days. It was built long and low with a crawl space under it open to the wind. The flooring was unsurfaced 2x12s, but the passage of many feet over it through the years had worn parts of it quite smooth. Evidently, green lumber had been used for flooring. By my time, the planks had shrunk until you could drop a pencil through the floor and then get permission to crawl under the schoolhouse to retrieve it. It didn't take the teacher long to get wise to such shenanigans. Not that pencils didn't get lost between the planks, but it wasn't much fun to have to retrieve them during recess or lunch hour, after which we were called to classes by the ringing of a handbell. This same method of announcing study time carried over to the new schoolhouse when it was built. Two rows of double desks filled most of the space in the main building. They started small in front and graduated progressively larger to the back. They had the standard ink wells and storage space between the top for books. In my mother's time, 30-some kids filled the seats to capacity. When I graduated from the 8th grade, only 12 of us were in school and several grades not represented. By then, we had a new schoolhouse, built modern with large windows on one end that let plenty of light in and painted gray. The desks were arranged so that our backs were toward the windows. I imagine that arrangement had been conceived to lessen the temptation of students to stare out the windows into space. A lean-to cloakroom partially extended across the front of the building. One side of the cloakroom was for the girls, the other for the boys. At various heights, nails had been driven into the walls on which to hang our coats and hats. A bench along each wall was convenient for taking off or putting on overshoes during time of need. Under the bench was storage space for overshoes and dinner buckets during school hours. The stars and stripes, raised and lowered by ropes and a pulley at the top, graced a flagpole in the schoolyard. Lowering the flag and putting it away after school was a rotating honor amongst the kids in the two upper grades. There were always small fry willing and eager to pull ropes and be a part of the flag lowering. It was raised in the morning by the teacher and was always there before the first student arrived. In cool weather, the teacher had to be at school extra early, not only to raise the flag, but to build the fire and get the building warm before school opened. In early years, the teacher boarded at different ranches, walked to school, or rode horseback if it was very far. Our teacher, when I was in the eighth grade, had a car and drove out from Pilot Rock. A woodshed was separate from the building. The new schoolhouse was built high enough off the ground so that there was ample storage space for wood and coal underneath, but no inside stairway. The school board saw to it that there was wood in the shed, but it was mainly up to the teacher to see that it reached the stove. In that regard, she did have lots of willing help from the students. It was a rare pupil that preferred study to bringing in an armload of wood. The boys didn't have a corner on that chore either. In wintertime, keeping the building warm was no small task. One side of the building had a row of small windows. They were so high above the floor, small kids couldn't see anything out of them except sky. During the warm days of autumn, the broken and missing window panes helped with the air conditioning and kept the building from getting uncomfortably warm. When cold weather came, that added considerably to the problem of warding off the chilled. The teachers partially remedied the heating problem by tacking up cardboard to take the place of the missing glass. There wasn't much she could do to stop the drafts that came up through the cracks in the floor. Near the front of the room between the first row of desks and the teacher's desk was a big pot-belly stove. Many is the day we students sat around the stove to keep warm instead of sitting at our desks. And on days that were really cold, we often wore our coats and overshoes. The blackboard, which was more green than black, covered the wall behind the teacher's desk. My fondest memories of that blackboard concerned the tissue-like paper, design perforated, that could be held against the blackboard and padded with an eraser, which left a series of little white chalk dots. The picture could then be drawn in by connecting the dots with a piece of chalk. School buses were an innovation of the future. Kids went to school either afoot or a horseback, sometimes by buggy or sleigh in the wintertime. Very rarely were they taken to school by a parent. Then it was more of a crisis situation because of bad weather conditions. That might be in the family jalopy if roads permitted it. Getting the car started could be no small task. Antifreeze wasn't available, so radiators had to be drained between use, especially overnight. The radiator then had to be filled with hot water from the tea kettle or reservoir of the stove. Even then, the coils of the Model T might require warming up in the oven before the engine would start. In cold weather, it was quicker and easier to jack up a rear wheel and let the whole powertrain turn when starting the motor. Otherwise, with the oil stiff and cold, the front end of the vehicle would practically lift up off the ground every time you'd pull up the crank. There were no paved roads. The only rock on the roads was what nature put there. The county didn't run a grader over the road nor a snowplow. Consequently, the use of motor vehicles was often stymied. It was at such times that Pa might take the kids to school by sleigh. Or maybe he or Big Brother, not in school, would take a small tot there behind him on a saddle horse. If a kid was big enough to ride his own horse or plow through the snow afoot, such emergency measures weren't necessary. Many kids rode to school on horseback behind an older sister or brother until they were big enough to have a horse of their own. They didn't have to be very old for that. I was sure proud the day I advanced from the rumble seat to holding the reins of my own horse. I only had a mile to go to school, but I didn't walk many days. Several kids had much further to go. Between Little McKay Creek and the schoolhouse on Stewart Creek was a nice half-mile flat that made an ideal racetrack. Several kids from our neck of the woods rode to school horseback. One little girl, until she was past the second grade, had to ride behind her brother, who was in the fourth by then. She didn't slow down our racing any. She'd hang on to the saddle strings, her feet practically sticking straight out, and stuck there like a cockle burr. She got as much fun out of it as anybody. One time in the spring of the year, when the frost was going out of the ground and the mud was plentiful, I got off to a bad start in a race. One kid, no matter to which side I tried to go to pass him or get away from the flying mud, kept reining his horse right in front of me on purpose. By the time we got to school, I was so plastered with mud, I had to spend a half hour at the creek cleaning up before the teacher would let me in the schoolhouse. That same year, a kid from town stayed with a neighbor for a while and went to school with us. He'd usually hitch a ride part way to school with me. By then, he'd have already walked more than a mile. When he was aboard, I always have to pull up short in the race. Instead of hanging on to me, he'd reach up and grab the horse's mane, then start pulling and shove me right out on the horse's neck. I most always rode to school bareback. Electricity wasn't available in our part of the country. Pilot Rock, the nearest town with a population between 200 and 300, had its own light plant. Even there, many houses weren't connected to the system. Lights were only available when the engine ran to turn the generator. It was only operated on the darkest of days and had a 10 p.m. shutoff at night. The light would blink a couple of times 15 minutes beforehand to warn users and give them time to get the old coal, oil, and gasoline reliables lit if they wanted more light. Our plumbing situation, too, was vastly different from that of modern schools. We packed our drinking water in a bucket from a nearby spring. There was a long-handled dipper in the bucket for communal use. The relief stations were two very small structures in opposite corners of the schoolyard behind the schoolhouse. A sign on one said, "Boys," and the other, "Girls." To relieve the structural plainness, both were beautified with the popular crescent cutout above the door. A porous vine that grew along the creek, when cut into lengths between joints, made a good substitute for cigarettes or cigars, depending on the size cut from the vine. It burned a bit warm, but made plenty of smoke. proper-sized lengths of elderberry stems partially when hollowed out and fitted with a wild ryegrass stem made ideal pipes. By hook or crook, usually by crook, real tobacco was sometimes available. Coffee made a good substitute, but it was sure hot on the tongue. We learned the art of rolling our own quite young. It was cause for real celebration when someone would occasionally come up with a package of tailor-mades. Of course, our smoking was done on the sly, as it didn't meet with popular approval. Amongst the brush and trees that grew along the creek bordering the schoolyard was a good place for such activity. Also, it was good for various games we played, such as swinging through the tree branches like a bunch of monkeys, or seeing how far we could go without touching the ground. One day, a boy came to school with a package of Lucky Strike cigarettes. Only a few brands were on the market at that time. It being a stormy day and too wet to rendezvous in the brush, during the noon hour, we boys crowded into the little house back of the big house and really smoked up a storm. When school took up, the teacher called us on the carpet for it. We couldn't figure out how she knew we'd been smoking until one of the girls told us later the smoke had been pouring out of the cracks between the boards thicker than it did in their smokehouse at home when they were curing hams and bacon. It seems nowadays that an awful lot of parents will jump to the defense of their errant offspring when a kid draws the reprimand of teacher or bus driver, even when the kid is lying through his teeth. So many seem to have the idea that their child can't possibly do anything wrong. One year, the school district up the canyon from ours had a young teacher fresh out of normal school. It was her first job. Some of the bigger boys had ideas as to how the school should be run that didn't coincide with the prescribed procedure. Consequently, the process of learning was seriously disrupted. With no control over the troublemaking boys, the poor teacher was at her wit's end and about ready to throw in the sponge when the parents in the district became aware of the situation. Small fry do carry home tales. They showed up en masse one morning at the schoolhouse. Their errant offspring were given to understand in no uncertain terms there'd be no more such shenanigans, or they'd be dealt with at home in a manner they wouldn't soon forget. The teacher didn't have any more trouble. That same year, we had a rather stern but fair teacher. We learned right off the bat that she wouldn't put up with any tomfoolery. She was a grandmother that had done a good job of raising her own family. She savvied kids and was an extra good teacher as well. In the learning process, the one-room school had some advantages not found where grades are isolated. Students couldn't help but gain some knowledge of subjects taught in grades ahead of them, thus being better prepared when they themselves reached that grade. Listening in on grades below them helped refresh their memories of things they'd already once learned, but may have partially forgotten. Sometimes older kids would help younger ones with their studies. Such activity was training good for both. It was while in attendance at the Little Red Schoolhouse that my mother saw her first automobile. It was a high-seated, open-aired, train-drive affair. The radiator had steamed up, and they'd stopped at the crossroads to fill it with water from the creek. Two hunters, dressed in the prevailing mode of the time, visored caps, goggles, long linen dusters, and gauntlet gloves, were from Pendleton on their way up Rocky Ridge to do deer hunting. The car made plenty of noise on its arrival to alert the students to the presence of something out of the ordinary. The schoolmaster led the way for the inspection tour. There was no more bookwork for the rest of the day. It was devoted to a lively discussion of the wonderful contraption they had just witnessed. After I was fully grown, I eventually pulled my picket pin and drifted off the home range to settle several hundred miles away. It was 40 years before I made a return visit. From the impetus of the lumber industry, the hometown had grown from a population of about 300 to 1,600. Electricity and better roads had come to the country, but the land itself was pretty much unchanged. The Table Rock on McKay Creek still stood as a guarding sentinel overlooking the valley. The Pallet Rock Bluffs were still the same as when first viewed by immigrants coming off the Blue Mountains. At my last view, the new schoolhouse of District 87, long deserted as a victim of consolidation and school buses, was in such a sad state of disrepair, it made the little old red schoolhouse akin to a mansion. The schoolyard, where I left so many footprints, was being grazed by a flock of sheep. Country Schooling was written by E.J. Kershaw. And let's turn in the September 1987 issue of the Good Old Days magazine to Remember With Me. It's written by Alan Sanderson. It always beats me why people say right as rain when describing some happy circumstance. What can be right about a frustrated little boy forced to stay indoors because of an unwelcome summer downpour? Is there anything right about a mother growing testier by the second due to the complaints of this sad little boy? I think not. Fortunately for us, both my mom was and still is a good card player. She taught me how to play fish one memorable afternoon that had promised to be as aggravating as past inclement days. You know the way in which this deathless battle of wits evolves. I'd be holding 3 tens. I'd ask mom if she had any. No, she'd smile, go fish, which meant taking one from the remaining deck. Then she'd draw a 10 on her turn and ask me of my hard-won 3, thereby gaining this complete set. But she kept my eyes dry by letting me win the majority of these encounters. From fish, I graduated to a group game called Donkey. We generally played this at night by the light of a kerosene lamp in our Rhode Island beach cabin. The idea was to collect 4 of everything in one's hand by either drawing or passing a card. The first one doing so would quietly lay his or her hands down and grab a token from the center of the table. Naturally, there was one less token than participants. The unlucky person coming up empty-handed would then inherit the letter D. 6 misses identified the D-O-N-K-E-Y, and Dame Fortune, more often than not, made an S out of yours truly. Later on, I became the teacher rather than the pupil, bringing home games the neighbor boys had pounded into me. My mom did tolerate lengthy sessions of The World Never Ends and Slap the Jack. However, she refused to engage in knuckles. The winning red cuts of the deck signified gentle taps on the fist with the cards, while black ones earned severe raps. And 52 pickup, the tossing of the cards into the air by one player, obligating another to pick them up. No, that's above and beyond a mother's call of duty, or so it was impressed upon me. Those had to remain kids' games. Actually, we did fall back on 52 pickup quite often. It was the only way we could shuffle. Playing cards probably originated in the Orient or in Egypt. Certain styles have become collectible. For example, a Lorillard tobacco edition, reputed to be the first American advertising deck, in valued around $100 at New England flea markets. A 1934 Chicago World's Fair issue brings $20. The thirst for a Coca-Cola entry is quenched at $10. Playing card souvenirs of the movie Jaws snaps up $8. Political figures haven't been forgotten either. A $12 figure has been voted upon to acquire a 1971 manufacturer singling out Richard Nixon. My dad, who shunned the touch of playing cards, introduced board games to me when I was bored on another rainy day. Does anyone still play checkers? Well, my dad was a whiz at this pastime. His battle plan called for clearing the field as soon as possible by forcing an opponent to jump in give and take fashion. With three or four checkers, hopefully clingers, left to each player, he'd plot his strategy. About 100 games down the road, I finally won. Or did he let me beat him? Anyway, envisioning a double slam family triumph, I then challenged my mom. It turned out to be no contest in the strictest sense of the phrase. Besides lacking my dad's skill, she also didn't possess his patience. My mom threw up her hands in frustration when I could merely move back and forth in the right-hand corner. She insisted I should acknowledge defeat since I couldn't roam freely around the board. I contended that as long as I could move, I hadn't yet lost. My dad, acting as a refereeing peacemaker, took her place and promptly maneuvered his men expertly, boxing me into a move where my sole choice was to be removed from the board. It became a habit to check on my dad for checkers and bid my mom to play cards. Remember With Me was written by Alan Sanderson and appears in the September 1987 issue of the Good Old Days magazine. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information, by Mark DeWitt.